This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in again today. If you're a new listener, welcome. This is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your money. We also interview a guest expert every week, and joining me in just about 1.5 minutes will be our guest expert today, Mr. Carl Lane. We're going to chat with Mr. Lane about the U.S. government debt. Can it ever be paid? What does it mean for you and your money? And we're going to look at it from an historical perspective. Professor Lane has written a book on the topic that I think you'll find to be very interesting. So looking forward to my conversation with him momentarily. On today's program, I will be talking about an economic indicator that's not referenced all that often. And yet, in my view, it's probably the most important economic indicator to consider when you want to consider what's the long-term health of the U.S. economy going to be. And that is private sector debt. And on today's program, we'll talk about some concepts that are going to be really important for you to understand. And more importantly, based on the current level of debt that we have in the economy, is where we're going economically and where your investments and nest egg might be going. Is that predictable? We believe it is, and I'll be taking segments 2 and 4 on today's program to explore that with you as well. Our new retirement rules classes are over for the summer. We do have one scheduled, though, for September 12, and information on that class is posted at newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio Program returning guest, Mr. Carl Lane. Carl is a professor of history at Felician College. He's also the author of the book, A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. Professor Lane received his PhD from the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His articles have appeared in William & Mary Quarterly, Virginia Magazine of History and Biography, and has written a number of other articles as well. And he's got another book project in the works that we'll talk to him about in our second segment. But welcome back to the program, Professor Lane.
Thank you very much, and thank you also for inviting me back.
Well, let's talk, Professor, about your book, A Nation Wholly Free. Talk about your motivation for putting all this time and effort into talking about and educating folks on the elimination of the national debt under President Jackson.
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One is, or I should say was now, the fact that most people simply are unaware that for almost all of our national history, except for 2 years and 10 months, January 1835 to October 1837, we have carried debt. And I knew but didn't know the political circumstances surrounding the elimination of the national debt in 1835. And I wondered, well, how was that accomplished? You know? And so I got into writing the book in order to rekindle memory of the fact that we've only had debt freedom for a very, very brief period in our history, and that given our current debt issue, maybe we can take confidence from the fact that we've lived with debt for a very, very long time. We've overcome it altogether only one time, and that therefore maybe we shouldn't be as discouraged as, say the recent Congressional Budget Office report would suggest.
For our listeners that maybe aren't familiar with that CBO report, fill us in.
Well, the CBO report that came out in June indicated that unless laws that are in place now changed, by the year 2040, we would be running a national debt greater than gross domestic product. I think, if I remember correctly, the prediction was 107%, and that, of course, would not be a healthy thing.
So let's go back and we'll talk about maybe what we can learn from your research, and we'll talk about your project in the second segment. But let's talk about the political climate of the time. What enabled the United States to be debt-free for this limited time frame?
Well, I think the fundamental reason was the fact that after the War of 1812, the Federalist Party disappeared as an institution in American life. It had tainted itself with treason at the infamous Hartford Convention of December 1814. And, of course, the opposition to the Republican Party labeled them trade wars and whatnot. As a result, those who had identified themselves as Federalists earlier on ceased to do that, and we wound up with a one political party system, namely the Jeffersonian Republicans. So there was a broad consensus. There was no opposition to the political dominance of the Jefferson Republican Party. And a key element in the Jeffersonian ideology, if I can use that word, was that national indebtedness was incompatible with individual liberty. And so, given that conviction, the Congress in 1817, overwhelmingly Republican, and I don't mean Republican in the sense of today, but Republican then, enacted legislation that planned out the elimination of the national debt. And there was no bickering about it. They didn't even have a roll call vote on the Redemption Act of 1817. And that piece of legislation went into effect. It defined the role of the Sinking Fund Commission that it relied on. And as a consequence, there was simply a wide acceptance of the fact that the debt had to go for reasons that had to do with American liberties. But in addition to that, or combined with that, was the fact that the American economy was really booming in the period after the Treaty of Peace with Great Britain. All elements, as President Monroe said in his last message, all elements of the economy were humming: the agriculture, commerce, and manufacturing, and the country was simply very, very prosperous. So, and I forget exactly what the rate of economic growth was, but the vibrant economic growth underpinned our economy during the period after the peace treaty with Great Britain. And that endured right up through the period of debt elimination on January 1, 1835.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting with Carl Lane. Carl is a professor of history at Felician College. His book is A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. And, Professor, we've got just over a minute left. Is there a lesson in what you just said, and we'll talk about this more in the next segment, that certainly when the economy's doing well and tax revenues are rising, that that's the time for politicians to be responsible?
Yeah, I sure do. And, we're coming up on the next segment. I have a lot more to say about that matter. But I do think that when times are good, that's when you need to prepare for the problems on the horizon. And, I mean, it's not raining on the United States right now, but we do see storm clouds on the horizon, and so it's time to get the umbrella ready. And this is the time to do it.
Well, looking very much forward to our next segment with Professor Lane. Hope you'll stay with us. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. I'll continue my conversation with Carl Lane in the next segment. You know, we've been chatting with Carl Lane about the last time the United States had no public sector debt. And certainly with today's public sector debt, as we've been talking about with Mr. Lane, there is a great deal of concern about what the end game will be. What will be the ultimate consequences of all this public sector debt that mathematically can simply not be paid? However, there is probably something that's even more important to consider purely from an economic forecasting perspective, and that is private sector debt. Not debt that the government has racked up, but rather private sector debt, debt that is racked up by you and your neighbor and businesses and corporations. This is an important yet little referenced economic statistic. In fact, it's probably the most important economic statistic, in my opinion. And there was an article published, Who Controls the World? And it was published by Business Insider. I want to give you just a bit from the article, and then I'll give you my comments and give you an explanation, because, again, this is very important to understand. The article has a subtitle, Too Much Government Debt Hurts the Economy, But Too Much Private Debt Kills It. Now, the article publishes a paper that was published by the National Bureau of Economic Research, and this paper analyzed 138 years of economic history in 14 advanced economies. And the conclusion of the paper was that high levels of private debt caused severe recessions and depressions. Now, here's just a summary of the Business Insider article. Through a series of tests run on a sample of 14 advanced economies between 1870 and 2008, Mr. Taylor, who is the author of the paper, establishes a link between the growth of private sector credit, basically debt incurred by the private sector, and the likelihood of a financial crisis. The link between financial crisis and private sector debt is stronger than the links between financial crisis and growth in the money supply, stronger than the link between financial crisis and the current account deficit, and stronger than the link between financial crisis and an increase in public sector debt. Over this 138-year time frame, the author of the paper finds that financial crisis is preceded by the development of excess credit, excess debt, as in Ireland and Spain today, and it is more commonly preceded by private sector debt excesses than excessive government borrowing like we're seeing in Greece. Now, the study shows that excessive private debt is a much more accurate and consistent predictor of financial crises than the amount of public debt. Now, the National Bureau of Economic Research study validates what a gentleman by the name of Steve Keen has been saying for years. Excess private sector debt is the main driver of deep recessions and depressions. Yet, when you listen to policymakers talk, when you listen to Ben Bernanke talk, when you listen to now Janet Yellen talk, who is the chair of the Federal Reserve, when you listen to a number of other mainstream economists talk, they say that the level of public debt, a level of rather private sector debt, doesn't matter. And in fact, it doesn't even really, it's not important enough to even count or quantify. Now, there is a Bank of International Settlements study, and the author of that was Mr. Michael Clark. And he said that in the study, he concluded that high levels of public debt are detrimental, but it's high levels of private debt which initiate depressions. Now, I'm going to explain to you why that is in a moment, but listen to this statistic. American private debt was 310% of gross domestic product or economic output in 2008. So private sector debt was 310% of economic output in 2008. If you look at 1929, it was 240% of GDP or economic output. So levels of debt today in the private sector are still higher than the levels of private sector debt that existed in 1929. Now, certainly when you look at government debt today, it's a lot higher also as a percentage of GDP than it was in 1929, which simply means that government may not have as many economic bullets to shoot to try to combat recessions and depressions. But here's the big question that we want to consider. Why does excessive private sector debt cause recessions and depressions? Well, there's a couple important concepts to understand to get this crystallized, to understand how it might affect you and your money. And the first thing you need to understand is that debt is money. I know that's a hard concept to understand, but debt is money. And when debt can't be paid, money disappears from the financial system. We say it goes to money heaven. And when the money supply contracts, that is deflationary. That's what happened in the 30s. That's what was happening during the financial crisis, and that's what really scared the Federal Reserve into printing money, engaging in quantitative easing. However, I'll explain to you also on today's program why the problem won't be fixed by Fed policy, in my opinion. But let's go back to this idea that debt is money for a minute. Let me just give you an example to maybe make the point clear. Let's assume that I have $50,000 in currency, in cash, and I have it under my mattress. Probably not a smart thing to do, but let's just assume for this example that I have $50,000 in cash under my mattress. And if I were to put together a personal balance statement, I would carry that $50,000 in cash as an asset on my personal balance statement. Now, let's say that I have someone come to me who says that, you know, I've just lost my job. I really need a loan. I'll give you my car as collateral. Can you loan me $50,000? I'll pay you a fair rate of interest. Well, I like this person. I trust this person. So I agree, and I pull the $50,000 cash from under my mattress, and I give it to this person, and I take their car as collateral. Now, if I were to fill out a personal balance statement again, I still have a $50,000 asset. It's just that now my $50,000 asset is not cash. It's not money under the mattress. It's a note that's payable to me, but it's still a $50,000 asset. Now, what if this person comes to me several months later and says, here's my car. I cannot possibly pay you back. My financial situation is such that it can't be remedied. I apologize. I can't give you your money back. Here's my car. So I take the car and I go sell the car and I get $20,000 for the car. What just happened to my personal balance statement? My personal balance statement just shrunk by $30,000. I loaned $50,000. I took a car as collateral. I sold the car, got $20,000 for it. And now my $30,000 went to money heaven. I'm not going to see it again. It simply disappeared from the financial system. That's what happens on a larger scale when debt can't be paid. Banks have on their books debt as assets. If that debt can't be paid, what happens? If enough of it can't be paid, it affects the solvency of the bank, and you see banks shutter like you did in Cyprus a few years ago and like we're seeing in Greece today. Now, the fact is there is more private sector debt today than there was during the Great Depression, and that is still the case. And I'll talk about this more in the last segment of today's program. And let me remind you, just some advance notice here, if you've missed our new retirement rules classes for the summer, they are now completed. However, we have scheduled the class for September 12th. So if you would like to go to the website, newretirementrules.com, and register, we expect that that class will reach capacity. So if you're thinking about attending the class, once the summer activities are over, September 12th, a Saturday, is a great day to do that. Go to newretirementrules.com and get more information and register. I'll be back with Mr. Carl Lane after these words.
Give me your money.
This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting again today with returning guest, Professor Carl Lane. Carl is the professor of history at Felician College, and we're chatting with him about his book, A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. And, Professor, we were chatting before our interview today, and you have another project in the works. Why don't you tell the listeners about what you're working on?
Well, my current project is to try to find some guidance from the era of Andrew Jackson when debt was totally eliminated and see if it can offer suggestions to us on how to move ahead given the size of our current debt, which is something I really want to say at the outset. The media, and I'm guilty of this myself, addresses our current national debt as exceeding $18 trillion. But that is a distortion of the reality, because that total is the gross national debt. But $5 trillion out of that $18 trillion is what's called intra-government holdings. Now, I don't know why that terminology is used, but it really represents intra-government debt. And so what that means is that our government borrows from itself, mainly from the Social Security Trust Fund, to cover budget deficits. But then we pay the lender interest. Now, I've been dealing with Andrew Jackson in terms of the first project for a lot of years, and I think I've come to know how he thinks or thought. And I think that he would have looked askance on the idea that one element of government was borrowing from another element of government. But at the same time that he might have looked askance at that, I think that he would have grudgingly acquiesced in borrowing within the government, because it would have been a lesser evil than borrowing from the public. So when if he had confronted this situation and the fact that the borrower within the government was paying interest to the lender within the government, I think that he would have drawn the line on that. Now, why do I mention that? Well, I mention it because the reality is that our public debt is really $13 trillion and change, and not $18 trillion and change. Roughly 30% of it is government owing the Social Security Trust Fund and Medicare Trust Fund and a few other trust funds all this other money with interest.
Professor,
and so I wonder about, and when I think about Andrew Jackson, what I think he would have thought about this kind of situation, I think it's something that deserves some serious study. And I would hope that President Obama or whomever his successor is would undertake to create a special committee to review this matter and see how those interest payments to the Social Security Trust Fund and Medicare Trust Fund and so forth might be more effectively used.
So, Professor, if I can imagine some of the listeners that listen to your explanation that about $5 trillion of the national debt is really money that one part of government owes the other part of government, maybe just to simplify that statement, Isn't some of that debt, though, debt that really is going to be used to pay liabilities, pledges that have been made to pay Social Security benefits, and that program's underfunded? Isn't that a relevant argument?
Well, it is a relevant argument, and I agree that whatever evaluation were made on this would have to be in consideration of the viability of the Social Security Trust Fund and the others. But here's the thing, I mentioned the Congressional Budget Office before the break, and as grim as the outlook is in their baseline projections out to 2040, there are some positives in the short run. For example, the budget deficits over the next few years are going to be less than they have been in the preceding 8 years. In other words, they will be less than 3% of gross domestic product between now and, I think, 2019. Another little nugget for the moment is that revenues are anticipated to increase from 17.7% of GDP to 18.3% between now and 2025. And lastly, according to the Congressional Budget Office report, the government's expenditure on health care, that is Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, these are going to dip downward, at least briefly, starting in 2017 and going through 2020, so that we have a moment here where possibly if we act promptly, promptly is not, I know that's not going to happen with a presidential election year coming up. Both parties will be looking to score points against each other rather than address very seriously this issue. But maybe that's just my cynicism showing.
I think we all share that cynicism, Professor.
Okay. But anyway, going back to the matter of the interest on the intra-government holdings, if the payment of that interest, which runs into the billions and billions of dollars, by the way, were simply postponed to cover the next 10 years of our addressing the debt matter, and the postponement, now I'm not talking about a cancellation, I'm talking about a postponement. If the revenues that were otherwise distributed to the interest payment over a decade were in fact invested in a sovereign wealth fund generating income. Now, I know that there are many Americans who would be concerned about that kind of a fund, because to many Americans, I think it would smack of socialism. But the reality is that a number of our states, most of them red states, have sovereign wealth funds. In fact, state of Alaska, I wouldn't remember this number without looking at it, sorry. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, on July the 13th, which is just a few days ago, had a total valuation of $54,313,700,000. That's a lot of money. Other states, Wyoming, Alabama, West Virginia, Oregon, have sovereign wealth funds. The United States of America does not have such a fund. And in the course of my research, I came across some commentary to the effect that the United States does not have a sovereign fund for historical considerations. And I really don't know exactly what that means, but I suspect it means that there is a bias among Americans against government purchasing stocks and bonds, certainly in the American marketplace. Overseas, I'm not quite sure.
Professor, we're sneaking up on the end of a segment here, and I want to be sure to ask you this question. Comparing what happened under President Andrew Jackson and where we are today, and you put forth an idea that would require politicians and policymakers not only to work together but also be disciplined for a period of time. And in order to accomplish what was accomplished back under President Jackson, it required, a fair amount or a large amount of discipline. Do you see that discipline exists today?
Well, no, I don't. And in fact, the discipline of the Jackson years broke down and resulted in the crash of 1837 that led to government resuming borrowing again. And it was because the bitterness of party spirit at the time led to policies that were poorly thought out. And I'm referring specifically to the Deposit and Distribution Act of 1836, which, if it had less than a month of debate in Congress, yet it was something that everyone in the Congress had to know. They had to know that this was of extraordinary importance to the future of the country, but they fumbled the ball because of the partisanship. Everybody wanted to score points against everybody else, and so we wound up with legislation that was disastrous. And, you know, to answer your question directly, I don't see that kind of discipline today. But if you go through the Congressional Budget Office report, based upon no changes in law, which is going to put us in a very, very bad situation going out to the year 2040, something's going to have to give. They're going to have to sit down at some point and discuss very, very seriously where we're going to go. Because if we don't, after 2040, we're going to be facing the possible failure of representative government. I can't believe that we're going to allow the Constitution to fail us. The politicians are going to have to step up to the plate. You had an opportunity to do so under the Simpson-Bowles a proposal several years ago. Both sides walked away from that because it involved giving up things that were vital to the base of each party. But at some point, they're going to have to do this. I mean, that's, to me, a given. They will have to do it.
Well, Professor, we are going to have to leave it there. We appreciate you joining us today. Our guest today has been Professor Carl Lane, author of A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. Thank you for joining us today, Professor.
Oh, thank you again for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and special thanks to our guest expert, Mr. Carl Lane, for joining us today. You know, while I've been chatting with Mr. Lane about government debt and some of the potential consequences of excess government debt, I have been focusing on probably what I believe is the most important economic indicator, although it's not referenced very often, and that is private sector debt. Excess private sector debt causes recessions and depressions. We talked about it earlier on Everything Financial Radio. Private debt right now is about 300% of gross domestic product, according to a Business Insider article that I referenced earlier. At the beginning of the Great Depression, private debt was 240% of gross domestic product. So the conclusion we've reached is that excessive private sector debt causes recessions and even depressions. And I talked previously about a couple important concepts, and the first is that debt is money. And when debt can't be paid, money disappears from the financial system. As I explained earlier, it goes to money heaven. And I gave you the example of loaning $50,000 cash that I'd had under my mattress, and I loaned it to someone that needed it, and I took their car as collateral. Well, basically, on my personal balance statement, that $50,000 in cash is still a $50,000 asset. It's now a $50,000 note that's payable to me. So if that person comes to me and says, I can't pay my debt, here's my car, you took it as collateral, and I can only go get $20,000 for the car, I just lost $30,000. That's $30,000 in cash that disappeared not only from my financial statement, but the financial system itself. And when the money supply contracts, it causes deflation, and deflation causes some pretty painful and pretty ugly economic symptoms. Now, why does this occur? Why do high levels of private sector debt cause recessions and financial crises? Well, the answer is pretty simple if you think about it. Debt accumulation is finite. Debt consumes tomorrow's production. Debt accumulation is finite because it consumes tomorrow's production, and tomorrow's production is finite. Let me explain what I mean by that. Let's say that you go down to the car dealership and buy a new car. You pay $25,000 cash for the car because you had money in the bank to pay cash. Your neighbor sees the car sitting in your driveway. She loves it and decides she wants to go get a car just like it. So she does. The difference is she doesn't have $25,000 in cash in the bank to pay for the car. She walks out of the car dealership with a payment book. She's going to make payments over the next 60 months on the car. You, by having $25,000 cash in the bank, spent prior production to buy the car. You went to work yesterday, or your investments went to work, and you accumulated $25,000 in cash. It happened in the past, and now you're going to spend that past production in the present. You're going to spend it now. Your neighbor has a payment book. She has to get up and go to work tomorrow to make money to make her car payment. So when she goes and buys that car today in the present, she's spending tomorrow's production. She's got to get up and go to work tomorrow to make her car payments. The reason debt accumulation is finite is that future production is finite. We can only spend so much of tomorrow's production because tomorrow's production is limited. And in essence, that's where we are today, economically speaking. Now, why do I believe that current Federal Reserve policy won't work long term? Even though, admittedly, when you look at the economy today, it seems pretty good. A lot of people think that the economy is improving. A lot of people working two part-time jobs would probably disagree with that. But here, in a nutshell, is why I believe the Fed policy won't work. And if you think about it, I think you'll agree with me. Let's assume that I have someone who's close to me that comes to me and says, I've just lost my job. I need $3,000 per month to make payments on my house and my cars and my credit cards. This person has a lot of debt. So let's just say that I give them $15,000 as a loan, and they put the $15,000 in the bank, and they just use that money to make their debt payments. They've got enough money in the bank to make their debt payments for the next 5 months. So month one, two, and three go by, and things seem like they're pretty decent. No creditors calling. They're eating. Everybody seems like, everything seems like it's going along just fine. Then all of a sudden, at the end of month five, the money that I gave them is gone. they have debt now staring them in the face once again, and they've got the same problem they had 5 months earlier. By giving them the $15,000, what did we do? We put a Band-Aid on the problem, and we kicked the can down the road, to use an old cliche, 5 months. Here's my point. Money printing, creating money, doesn't make the debt go away. You still have to deal with the consequences of debt. And the eternal truth is, if there's too much debt to be paid, which at the beginning of the Great Depression, with private sector debt levels at 240% of the economy, there was too much debt to be paid. Today, debt levels are even higher. There's still too much debt to be paid. And if there's too much debt to be paid, it simply will not be paid. And we will get symptoms of deflation unless the Fed decides that they want to engage in another quantitative easing program. Then they might kick the can down the road a little bit further. But every time you kick the can down the road, it makes, in my view, the ultimate economic consequences more severe. So money printing does not make debt go away. You still have to deal with the debt, and if there's too much debt to be paid, it won't all be paid, and that simply means that money will disappear from the financial system. That means that asset bubbles, asset prices, will fall. In my view, we have seen the real estate bubble build and burst about a decade ago. I believe that real estate is probably in another bubble currently. I think when you look at the bond market, bonds are likely in a bubble currently as well. And when you look at stocks, as we've talked about on past programs, we believe that stocks are probably also in a bubble as well. If you'd like to get our weekly analysis of what's going on in the markets, what's going on in the economy, I'd like to invite you to get a free subscription, if you'd like, to our weekly market update called Portfolio Watch. Portfolio Watch can be ordered for free. It's delivered by email. We don't share your information with anyone by simply visiting the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. The website is yourretirementoutlook.com. There's a place on the website for you just to enter your name and email, and we will be glad to get you our Portfolio Watch newsletter that comes out every week. So again, the website is yourretirementoutlook.com, and if you'd like more information about our new retirement rules class, we've got one coming up on September the 12th. It will be held at Western Michigan University's downtown campus in Grand Rapids. All the details are posted at the website, newretirementrules.com. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.